Hi, I'm Philip Anthony Albertelli, and welcome to The Week in Doubt, episode 25, Alan Watts and the Ground of All Being. I just released an episode yesterday, so this is a bit of an irregularity. Usually I only publish one episode a week, but I had a topic I really wanted to talk about, and I just didn't feel right to merge it with the episode I released yesterday. So I decided, what the heck, let's do two this week. In at least a couple of past episodes, I've gotten into the difference between a personal and impersonal God. And just to reiterate, a personal God would be a God either with a anthropomorphic form, or could be a God who doesn't have human form, is pure spirit, but still has human characteristics, traits, maybe even foibles. If we look at all those dead religions we now call mythologies, let's look at ancient Greece. You have gods like Zeus, Ares, Aphrodite, although sometimes they may take on animal forms or something like that. For the most part, they're depicted as having physical form. They have personalities, they have an individual will, etc. Those would be examples of a personal God. And the God of the Bible, Yahweh, would be an example of a personal God. Even if he doesn't have a anthropomorphic form, says, you know, there is that portion of the Old Testament about God creating man in his image, but that could be taken figuratively as a kind of spiritual image, not a physical image. So even if he doesn't have a physical form, God is at least, the God of the Old Testament is at least a personal God in the sense that he's sentient, he's self-aware, he has a will, he passes judgment, he gives laws, makes decrees, lets his wishes be known. So in that sense, Yahweh is a personal God. And it's interesting, the ancient Jews were forbidden from creating the likeness of the human form in art. And I think trying to depict God especially would have been considered blasphemous. But of course, we know about all those great masterworks, those great paintings and sculptures that were done during the Renaissance. And we think of the Sistine Chapel and God in physical form, touching his finger to the finger of Adam, giving him the spark of life. And it's very common in medieval art to see God depicted as this kind of patrician type of figure with the long white beard and the white hair. How literal that was taken by people then, I'm not sure. I suppose diametrically opposed the idea of the personal God is the impersonal God. And that's something we encounter a lot in Eastern religion. And an impersonal God is usually thought of as some kind of cosmic oneness, some sort of universal spirit. And to try to keep myself from getting confused and to thusly avoid possibly confusing you, the listener, or leading you astray, I started composing a little glossary of for myself of spiritual and religious notes on different subjects. And I started to, I'm reading from my iPad, I started to make a list of different terms that refer to that kind of cosmic oneness or an impersonal God. Sometimes it's referred to as the all, a universal spirit, which would be, say, for example, the concept of Brahman in the Hindu religion. I'll get a little bit more into that in a while. Sometimes it's referred to as the One or simply One, the supreme totality or totality of all beings. And in this sense, it was talked about by Plotinus, who is a 3rd century Greek philosopher. The sense of oneness can also be referred to as the absolute, the ground of all being. Aldous Huxley, who I'm a fan of, and when I was relatively young, just really getting interested in philosophy and religion, I read his book, well, books, often sold together as one, The Doors of Perception and Heaven and Hell. And Huxley would use the term a lot, the mind at large, almost referring to this kind of repository of consciousness and knowledge that anyone could tune into. And in the book, The Doors of Perception, Huxley talks a lot about the use of psychedelic drugs and how he thought they helped to kind of disable these filters we have that keep us kind of with our feet firmly on the ground, that keep us able to function in the mundane world and focus on mundane things. And when that kind of filter is short-circuited, or when it's shut off by the use of psychedelic drugs, then we can more easily commune with that kind of quote-unquote cosmic oneness. We can access that mind at large. It's kind of, you hear people who've experimented with psychedelic drugs speak almost the way practitioners of Eastern religion do. You hear a lot about the ego self dissolving or going away, and the sense of cosmic oneness or unity replacing it, which, depending on the mindset you enter into the experience with, can either be a beautiful or terrifying thing. A term that's used a lot and when talking about both Western and Eastern philosophy is Godhead or the Godhead. And I think it can be used to refer to a personal or an impersonal God. Sometimes you'll even hear the word Godhead in reference to Christian philosophy or theology. But often you'll also hear the term Godhead used when discussing, say, the Brahman in Hinduism, or the Godhead can be seen as being identical with the ground of all being, this kind of underlying oneness or universal spirit. And then in Buddhism, there's Dharmakaya, which I think literally translates in Sanskrit, from Sanskrit to English, to something like truth body. And it was believed that the Buddha had a few different bodies, so to speak. But Dharmakaya, the truth body, was limitless. And here I'm quoting a Wikipedia article, of course. From Wikipedia, one Buddhist scholar writes of it as the body of reality itself, without specific delimited form, wherein the Buddha is identified with the spiritually charged nature of everything that is. And I think it's been a while since I've really read up in on Buddhism. There was a time when I was younger, maybe my late teens, very early 20s, I was going through a tough time. And it was really when I was experiencing a lot of existential angst, because I had really begun to close the door on any chance of recovering my Christian beliefs. I think at this time, you know, I started to respect Jesus as a quote-unquote philosopher. I was starting to let go of some of my anti-Christian or Catholic rage that I felt when I was younger, when I think I felt betrayed by the loss of God in a way, and so I railed against religion, specifically Christianity. But maybe somewhere around there in my early 20s, I started to make my peace with Christianity, in a sense that even though I didn't believe in its claims or its doctrine literally, at least I could still appreciate some of the more admirable aspects of it. And even the story of Jesus, or I could appreciate a lot of things about Jesus, his wise teachings, things like that. But I had really started to feel as though I could no longer believe in a personal creator God. I felt like Christianity was man-made like the rest of the religions. Its supernatural claims couldn't be vetted any more than those of any other religion. And I kind of started to spiral into a dark place. And Buddhism and Eastern religion helped me through that in a sense, because I was able to realize that you didn't need to believe in a creator God to have a sense of spirituality, or to enjoy the mystery that is existence. So the Buddha, the historical Buddha, is very interesting. Prince Siddhartha, of course, if you are familiar with the story, unlike Jesus, who came from humble beginnings, the historical Buddha was a prince. He lived a sheltered life, if you believe the story. And as a grown man, when he encountered things like aging, sickness, and death for the first time, he was so moved that he wanted to find a cure or a remedy for suffering. And so he renounced his noble status, left all the luxury of the palace behind, went into the wilderness and started to meditate and experimenting with different ways of trying to find salvation from suffering. And even though Hinduism, which Buddhism came out of, kind of the way that Christianity came out of Judaism, Hinduism had a plethora of gods. You could say in a weird way, the Buddha was almost like an atheist in the sense that he didn't think that salvation was going to come from any of those gods, or you shouldn't really focus on them. Instead, you should focus on basically extinguishing desire. I won't get into it now, but there's the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and the Buddha's basic idea, that kind of at the heart of Buddhism, is the idea that suffering comes from desire. And the way to end suffering is therefore is by escaping or extinguishing desire. And the more you cling to the flesh, the more you cling to the world, the greater your desire and your suffering is. So in Buddhism, the idea was to kind of extinguish the ego self and become one with everything as much as possible. And thusly, you could, start down the road to escaping suffering. And in Buddhism, there's the concept of samsara, birth and death. And it was thought that, in a way, reincarnation was a kind of punishment. And, of course, your behavior helped to dictate what you'd be reborn as, if it would be lower or higher down the ladder, so to speak. And the Buddha thought to escape suffering, you had to escape the endless cycle of birth and death. And if you did that, you'd be kind of rewarded, if I don't know if that's the right word. But if you could let go of your ego, extinguish desire, break the cycle of birth and death, then, upon your death, you would enter nirvana, this state of kind of non-being. And it translates from Sanskrit into English is something like the extinguishing of the flame or blowing out of a candle, something like that. And that can be very hard for a Westerner to wrap their head around, because we're raised to put so much emphasis on the idea of everlasting life and wanting to live forever and maintain the ego self forever. But I think, so in a sense, you could include nirvana as one of those terms for cosmic oneness, even though technically it's more of a term relating to non-being. But I think before the Buddha, the term Nirvana existed in Hinduism, where maybe in that context you could use it more as kind of like a reference to the absolute or the ground of all being. And then, as I mentioned earlier, in Hinduism, there's the concept of the Brahman, and it can get very confusing because there's a few similar words in when we're talking about Hinduism that can become easily confused. There's a Brahmin, B-R-A-H-M-I-N, sometimes A-N at the end, which refers to a member of one of the four castes in a traditional Hindu society. And then Brahmin with the A-N at the end, B-R-A-H-M-A-N, can also refer to the Supreme Self, the Godhead, the ground of all being. And then Brahma is kind of the creative, I'm reading from Wikipedia once again, the creative aspect of universal consciousness. And now I'm not reading from Wikipedia, but in Hinduism, I think sometimes, I'm not sure if Hindus always believe in their multitude of gods, literally. I think sometimes they're seen as different manifestations of the absolute or the Godhead. And famously in Hinduism, there's the Trimurti, the Vedic Trinity. We have Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the preserver, and Shiva, the destroyer, and three gods manifesting creation, preservation, and destruction. In the Greek, in ancient Greek, there was the concept of the monad, and I think that it's a term that the followers of Pythagoras used, and it amounted to something like the first being or the totality of all beings, the source of kind of undivided oneness, or a oneness without division. Then the philosopher Hegel talked about the universal mind. And here I'm quoting again, universal mind may be defined as the non-local or atemporal hive mind of all aggregates, components, knowledges, constituents, relationships, personalities, entities, technologies, processes, and cycles of the nature of the universal mind. Of the nature of the universal mind is omniscient, omnipotent, omnificent, and omnipresent. It's believed that one has access to all knowledge, known and unknown, through the universal mind. People have access to an infinite power, one that is able to tap into the limitless creativity of the One. All these attributes are present within one at all times in their potential form. Still quoting, the notion of universal mind came into the Western canon through the pre-Socratic philosopher Anaxagoras, who arrived in Athens sometime after 480 BC. He taught that all things were created by nous, mind, and that mind held the cosmos together and gave human beings a connection to the cosmos or a pathway to the divine. So you can see what all these different terminologies, what they have in common is this idea of universal or cosmic oneness, an undivided oneness that we can commune with, that we come out of, return to. And then I might be guilty of using the term collective consciousness in the wrong sense in past episodes of the show. I think in its standard use, or its originally intended use, it's a term from mainstream psychology. I think it was coined by Emile Durkheim, and it just referred to the shared beliefs, moral attitudes of a society as a whole. There was nothing really hokey or supernatural about it. But according to this article, the term can also be used sometimes in a parapsychological sense, in parapsychology. And it says that in this sense, it was kind of adopted by a psychologist named Gardner Murphy. And he thought that the human mind, consciousness, might be able to survive death, but not as an individual self, that almost in kind of a fragmentary sense, would return to some greater consciousness at large. And sometimes in past episodes, I would use the term collective consciousness to kind of refer to universal spirit or ground of all being. But I think that's the less used definition of collective consciousness. I may have been an error to some degree using it in that sense. Then, of course, in Jungian psychology, there's the collective unconscious. And in the collective unconscious was kind of a reservoir or a kind of repository of these archetypes and kind of inherent beliefs or triggers that all of humanity shares. And I think they might, sometimes a collective unconscious may have even been, there was a personal unconscious, which, quote, is a personal reservoir of experience unique to each individual, while the collective unconscious collects and organizes those personal experiences in a similar way with each member of a particular species. And as I said, the collective unconsciousness would house these kind of archetypes, these symbols and concepts that are kind of innate in us and have meaning to all of us. And I don't know if there was any spiritual or preternatural aspect to that kind of Jungian or Freudian idea of the collective unconscious. I don't know. Because in a sense, you hear scientists or zoologists talk about generational memory, how elephants supposedly are able to find their way to water holes used by their ancestors. I'm not sure what the modern scientific view on generational memory is. I don't know if it's been debunked at all. Maybe you could explain it by elephants follow each other throughout the generations and learn the ropes where things are in their surroundings. Maybe animals that are said to have generational memory, maybe there's more of a mundane explanation where instead of inheriting the knowledge of where something is, they just learn by following the older members of the group who already know the way. But don't take that to the bank. Maybe there is something to generational memory. And then also, I kind of think from personal experience and what I've heard or read, that maybe we do have these kind of inherent concepts or fears or maybe genetic memories in a sense, where, you know, all humans in general seem to maybe have a fear of certain types of animals, whether it's sharks or reptiles. Or I remember when I was younger, I used to have to try not to think of like a plesiosaur or a great white shark or something before I went to sleep, because there was a good chance I would have a nightmare. So I don't know if maybe there's some evolutionary or Darwinian explanation for how the fear of certain predators or animals, fear of the dark, things like that, can be genetically passed on. I don't know, but I'm kind of digressing. I guess what I'm getting at is I don't know if Jung meant the collective unconscious as if he had some kind of down-to-earth, mundane explanation for how it worked, or if he thought there was something preternatural behind it, that maybe it had to do with some kind of universal mind or something like that. But anyway, on to the next part of the show. What inspired me in part to want to talk about all this is I, by happenstance, viewing something else, noticed a Alan Watts video on YouTube. And then before you know it, I watched about six of them. And Alan Watts was a British-born, but I think he spent a great deal of his time in America, philosopher and scholar. And He's well known for helping to introduce or popularize Eastern religion to the West back, say, around the 60s or something like that. And he even did a bunch of black and white talks back around 1960 on different subjects having to do with Eastern philosophy, and you can actually find those on YouTube. And I remember when I was probably in my late teens, early 20s, when I really started to get into Eastern religion. I think one of the first books I ever read was Alan Watts's famous book, The Way of Zen. And I have to admit, until I started watching these YouTube videos, I had only read the words of Alan Watts. I had never actually heard his voice or seen him speak. And I was amazed by what a powerful speaker he was and how articulate he was. It's been a while, I think, since I've heard or seen a speaker of that caliber. And it's got an interesting side note. I guess he was friends with a couple other people I admire. In a recent episode of the show, I talked about how I recently discovered the philosopher, I guess, call him a philosopher, connoisseur of religions, I think is how he sometimes referred to himself, Robert Anton Wilson. I guess they were friends to some degree. And also Alan Watts was friends with Gary Snyder. And if you are a Kerouac fan, I've read most of Kerouac's books. One of my favorites, one of the first I ever read, is The Dharma Bums. And Kerouac had a habit of changing the names of characters who are inspired by real figures. And in The Dharma Bums, the character of Jaffe Ryder was inspired by Gary Snyder, who, like Watts, was a Eastern religion practitioner and enthusiast. So I was listening to this talk by Alan Watts that in particular really moved me or caught my interest. And it wasn't one of the old black and white ones where he's actually, you can see him presenting the talk. There was just a still image someone had used of some kind of cosmic landscape. And you could hear Alan Watts giving this talk. I think it was in part a critique of Western ideas about how we perceive reality or the nature of the universe or existence. And he was talking about how people from the Judeo-Christian tradition tend to think of the universe as something created. God is kind of this big cosmic potter. And on the other hand, and I don't know when he gave this talk, it must have been decades ago, but even then he was acknowledging this kind of rise of atheist and agnostic belief. And he talked about how in both the cases of the devout and the non-believer in Western culture, they both view the universe as an artifact, in a sense, something that was created in one sense of the word or another, as almost, you know, an object, a creation or an invention or something. On the one hand, the religious believe that it was created by God. On the other hand, the non-believer believes that it's a fully automatic machine, kind of, you know. On both hands, it's a, and I don't want to get off the topic, but a little bit, this reminds me of the clockmaker idea we find in Western philosophy sometimes, where the universe is like a clockwork invention and God is the divine clockmaker. So in a sense, you saw in Western terms, we tend to think of the universe as something like that, an artifact, and it's either created by a divine artisan, and in the other idea, the non-believer's worldview, it's fully automatic, fully automated. And of course, I don't want to get into it again. I always talk about the problem of infinite regress. Both the religious person and the atheist or non-believer, and I guess I've, obviously I'm in that camp as I describe myself, agnostic at best, atheist at worst. So both people like myself who doubt a God and those who believe in God are left with the problem of infinite regress. Where did God come from? If you believe in the fully automated model or fully automatic model of the universe, who made that? And I won't get into the usual talk about Lawrence Krauss and the theory of everything and, you know, the attempts to explain where how something could come from nothing. I've already been over that. But it's interesting. So Alan Watts, it kind of seemed like he was maybe doing a little finger wagging over our tendency to think of the universe as a kind of artifact in a way. And that's his word I'm using. I don't know if maybe he was avoiding the word creation because it was too loaded. And what I'm going to go into next ties into what I was discussing when describing or listing all those different terms used to refer to the ground of all being, the absolute, the Godhead. Alan Watts was talking about how there's another model that we find in Hinduism, where the world is kind of seen as a drama that the Godhead, I guess you could say Brahman, acts out, in that all of us, everything, every person, every animal, every grain of sand, every blade of grass is a manifestation of the Godhead, a manifestation of God, God at play, in a sense, as it were. And he went on to explain, like, well, isn't that strange? If everything's just God at play, why would that be? And this was very, very fascinating. This is probably one of the most mind-blowing things I've heard in a while. Because, you know, I've been really familiar with this idea of the ground of all being or an impersonal God for a long time. But it's been a long time since I read deeply into Hinduism or thumbed through the Upanishads or the Bhagavad Gita, something like that. So I forgot how profound this idea of God as everything in the Hindu sense can be. And he said, imagine that you could dream about whatever you wanted to dream about. You could go to sleep at night and you'd know you were dreaming. You could choose what you want to dream about. You could just indulge yourself in whatever fantasies. And if you wanted to, you could make it richer by choosing to live 75 years worth of grand experience in one night. And he said, now imagine that after a while, that gets boring. So you say, all right, now when I go to sleep, I'm going to remember that it's just a dream. But instead of just dreaming about whatever pleases me, I'm going to make it more exciting by making things a bit more unpredictable, having some kind of adventures where you're not sure how the outcome's going to be. Then he says, maybe you do that for a while, then you get bored with that. So you say, let's make it even more exciting. Let's make it a bit dangerous. Now let's forget that we're, it's a dream and make things even more exciting and perilous. And no, actually, maybe at this state you haven't yet forgotten it's a dream, but you gotta make things even more perilous and dangerous, but at least you know, you'll be able to wake up. And then he goes a step further and he says, now imagine that, you know, you make things a bit more perilous, a bit more unpredictable, and you allow yourself to forget that you're dreaming. And he said, then you'd pretty much be living the life you're living now. the human life that we're in, where we're no longer aware that we're God at play. We're no longer aware that it's just a dream or an illusion of sorts. And I thought that really stopped me in my tracks, that whole kind of idea of, you know, basically being able to indulge yourself in fantasies, in fantasy at night, dreaming about whatever you want, getting bored so you make it a little bit more exciting, then you make it a little bit more dangerous, still aware at least that you'll wake up, then dangerous still, unpredictable still, but you're no longer aware that it's a dream, and that's the life we're living. I'm not saying I necessarily believe that, but it's a profound idea. Then Alan Watts went into talking about how in Hinduism, on a larger scale, on a cosmic scale, there's something known as a kalpa, that's like a unit of time. And the universe over 4 million and some change years, each kalpa goes, you go from God, the Godhead or the universe goes from a dreaming state into a waking state. And in the dreaming state, it's kind of like the state I described before, where there's different stages. At first, the longest stage, everything's beautiful and enjoyable. The second stage, things get a little bit more exciting. Then they get, I think it's maybe in the third stage, you have lightness and dark are almost at a stalemate, the forces of light and dark, forces of evil and good. And then the fourth state is basically nightmarish, and the forces of evil win. But just like a bad dream, at least you have that bang and you wake up. And then there's a long period where the universe or the Godhead is fully aware, and it's now awake, no longer dreaming. And then, once again, it enters the dream cycle. Why? According to Alan Watts, because of the spirit of adventure. Maybe the Godhead gets bored and wants to forget, you know, have some more adventures and forget who it is for a while. And there you have the God at the God or the Godhead, the Brahman, at play, manifesting itself through everything, through all of us. And so we're all just kind of masks of eternity, masks of the Godhead. And I think he went into explaining how in, I believe, ancient Greek theater, you know, the actors would wear masks, and they'd have round mouth holes that acted as kind of megaphones to project their voices while on stage. And I think it was a Latin word, personae or something like that, a Latin form of, you know, the root of the word person, which means to speak through or something like that. So here we use the word person referring to, you know, we think of as a solid, concrete individual. But even in the root of the word person, there's this kind of reference to acting and masks, and maybe things not being exactly what they are. And he went into, and this is where I think I really kind of take issue and my moral sensibilities kind of kick in, where he talks about how, I'm sure he wasn't promoting you know, evil acts, but he's talking about how in this model, everything is one. Everything is a mask of the Godhead. So your enemy, you know, if you're at war, the good guys and the bad guys, the evil doer and the good person, they're all the same God at play, the same Godhead manifesting itself in different forms. It's basically a dream. And he goes into talking about, you know, the suffering in the world, which theologians and philosophers and all of us, I think, have a problem with. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do bad things happen at all? And he used the depressing example of a baby with syphilis. And he says, even the baby with syphilis is, Brahman is a manifestation of the Godhead. And that's how, from that perspective, you would explain suffering. That's basically all a dream that the Godhead will eventually wake up from. And he used the analogy of how at the end of a play, the villain and the hero both come out, maybe hold hands and take a bow, and people realize it was all an illusion. I'm not saying I believe all this. I don't think I do, but it touches something in me, and maybe you too. Maybe that's why the idea is so powerful and why it's been around so long, as it touches some kind of nerve in us. It speaks of some kind of truth on some level. But I think earlier when he had been discussing a rise in non-belief, even in his day when he was giving the talk, how there's this depressing idea of the, when you're talking about that artifact model of the universe is kind of this clockwork thing, either God set it in motion or it's fully automated. And if you're a non-believer, then maybe you think you're just this flash in the pan between two darknesses, and that can be very depressing. And I think he was kind of talking about the drama model, that Hindu model, as a kind of cure for that, in a sense, or an alternative. And I think it's a beautiful idea. I think it's a beautiful and a terrifying idea, everything is the ground of all being. Everything is the Godhead at play. It is a profound idea. At the end of the day, I don't take it literally, and I do have some moral issues with trying to use supernatural explanations of any variety to explain suffering. But still, it's a lot of food for thought. And in case I didn't emphasize it enough earlier, and while I'm talking about the difference between a personal and impersonal God is a God that's self-aware, a God that maybe has or maybe doesn't have anthropomorphic form, but at least has awareness and has human traits, maybe even human foibles, whereas an impersonal God is kind of, is that ground of all being. It's kind of, as the term suggests, impersonal. It doesn't have a personality. It doesn't really have an ego self. It's this all-pervasive universal spirit. Let's see, this has already been twice as long, perhaps more so, than yesterday's episode. So I'll just call it a wrap and allow myself to take a break. So that's two episodes in 2 days. As always, this has been The Week in Doubt. You can be a mensch and like us on YouTube or Facebook, subscribe on YouTube, rate us on iTunes or Podbean. And as always, thanks for listening.